They came from a world that was oppressive, ruled by kings and queens and popes and prelates and bishops and lords and barons, who just because they didn't like the way you look could chop you into quarters and throw you to the pigs if they wanted to, anytime they wanted to. And if you didn't believe the religion they wanted you to believe in, they'd burn you at the stake or torture you. In some way, make your life absolutely miserable. They came here to create a new world, free from all of that. But they knew that they could not be safe in the new world if the old world was the way that it was. How do you get rid of kings and queens and barons and lords and emperors and prelates and sultans and emirs? How do you do that? A new world order. From the beginning, that was the goal, ladies and gentlemen. That's the absolute truth. From the very beginning, that was the goal. What do you think new world means? What do you think it means? So they did something that was unheard of, never been done in the history of the world. They set the cattle free.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, broadcasting from the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just on Jamaica Street here in Bristol in the UK. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, lockdown lunacy spreads as Israel announces its second wave lockdown to stop all Jewish festivals. And protests against the Prime Minister as well. And the UK government threatened to repeat original mistakes and turn sick elderly people out once more from hospitals into care homes, spreading the virus all over again. Almost unbelievable, isn't it? And meanwhile, we have two Trafalgar Square demonstrations taking place tomorrow and next Saturday in an attempt to convince MPs not to renew the Coronavirus Act legislation, which led to unprecedented disruption of society in a world that seems to have forgotten whether people are actually ill or not. Meanwhile, as everybody is distracted, it's a good time to bury Julian Assange. We get two reports on the case this week, one from the National Union of Journalists, Tim Dawson, another one from the renowned reporter, documentary maker from Australia, just like Julian is, John Pilger. Plus, on the international stage, the internet documentary Who's Behind Bill Gates? And plus, a roundup of David Livingstone taking us from the scientists of the Royal Society behind Darwin to the origins of Salafism and fake Muslim schools of thought, which eventually became the terror groups we know so well today, the Salafists and people like that, that have been fighting in Syria. Quite an interesting journey from this Muslim scholar, the author of The Dying God and also the author of Transhumanism, the History of a Dangerous Idea. Anyway, Martin, welcome. And I suppose we should start really by asking you again how your week's gone at school. It's the second week you've been back, isn't it?
Well, the second week I've been back. I mean, others have been back longer. We're just getting on with stuff. Everybody's supposed to stay in their little pods. We're not having any school dinners like everybody has to bring a packet.
So you are attached to, I mean, this is interesting, isn't it, the way that they've adopted this whole bubble idea that we had when I was stuck over in New Zealand. Mm. It was clear right from the start that was what was going to happen. A family, a household is a bubble, and yeah, you can mix fine within your own bubble, but you're not supposed to mix with others, which does rather make a mockery of this whole idea of a maximum of certain number of people being able to meet, because it might be more than that makes up one bubble.
Well, we've got more than that in Orca class, which I'm working in. And of course, all of the families are therefore in that larger bubble. But I think the idea is that that class, we're not supposed to mix with people from other classes. And that, the idea is to just create as many firewalls as possible for the virus.
Yes, well, whatever this virus is, it doesn't seem to be anywhere near as potent as the one that was in the normal flu season. But what's happened to the children? Do you think they're glad to be back?
By and large, yes. I mean, I think they want to see their friends, and they're not necessarily keen on doing maths every morning, some of them, but nevertheless, they want to be there to play with their friends, because obviously during lockdown they couldn't.
Well, what sort of effect do you think this has had overall the last 6 months, not going to school, on children? Positive or negative?
Well, I think for some kids it's actually been relatively easy, because they've got a very relatively supportive family environment. And for others, it's been much more challenging because their family environment isn't so supportive and the school is a place of respite for them. Although many of those children did come in throughout the lockdown. Unfortunately, there's a kind of a certain section of children who are not recognised as being under, vulnerable because they haven't got a piece of paper that says they are. And those are probably the ones that have actually had the worst time, because the ones that have, where it's recognised that they're vulnerable, they've actually been in school all along. And the other ones, the others with a supportive family, they've been out of school, but it's okay. But there's certainly certain kids who've been out of school, who should have been in school, as vulnerable, but they weren't classified as vulnerable, so they're the ones who probably suffered the most.
So the ones who have been coming to school, are they, for example, children of essential workers?
There's two rules, isn't there? There's children of essential workers and also children who are classified as being vulnerable in one way or another. And that, of course, is actually an official classification of special needs. And some kids have got special needs, but as we know, they're not all classified. And that's where the problem lies, because if they're not classified, then you can't actually mobilise resources to support them.
Anyway, we'll be talking more about coronavirus. Obviously, it's sort of swamped us all. It certainly seems to have swamped coverage of Julian Assange's trial, but not on this show, a bit later on. But let's start by looking at this enormous announcement, which has got only little blips in the news this week, Martin, which is Hitachi, the Japanese high-tech firm, pulling out of Wilfer. Now, Wilfer is a nuclear power station up on Anglesey, which has been stopped. It was been going for years. Then it was decommissioned. I think it's probably a more technical term than stopped. And now they're looking at recommissioning it, building a new reactor or recommissioning the old reactor. And Hitachi were involved in that. They've pulled out this week. So they're saying, no, we're not doing that. And it's the second Japanese company to pull out of British nuclear power plants in the last year or so. This has also led to a whole load of questions about just how viable this industry now is. Was it always likely to happen since it's such a high cost business, nuclear power?
I think so. I mean, basically the economics have never really stacked up, and the latest attempt to try and restart the nuclear industry, if you like, has been very much on the back of climate change concerns. But you can see the economics of energy have changed dramatically as a result of the economic crisis, lockdown, the collapse of the price of oil. And presumably Hitachi, which is a private company, will have made the decision to pull out because they can't see how they can make any money.
So let's have a listen now to a little extract from the BBC's 6 o'clock news bulletin on, I think it was Wednesday evening that I heard, and see what they had to say, because there's quite a lot in this. Have a close listen and you'll hear all sorts of, it's almost like they're explaining here that this is not just about Wilfer, it's a kind of house of cards.
It's understood that the collapse of a project to build a nuclear power station at Wilfer in Anglesey could accelerate approval for a new facility at Sizewell in Suffolk. Sources have expressed disappointment at the decision by the Japanese firm Hitachi to pull out of the Anglesey project, but insisted that the government remained fully committed to nuclear power as a way of decarbonising the UK's power supply by 2050. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
A decade ago, government ministers talked enthusiastically about a new nuclear age. Of 6 sites then identified, only 1 is under construction, 3 have been abandoned, and 2, Sizewell and Bradwell, are still waiting for the green light. One major sticking point over Sizewell has been the involvement of Chinese state-owned company CGN, which already owns a 33% stake in Hinkley Point C in Somerset, currently under construction by French firm EDF, which owns the other 2/3. CGN also agreed to take a 20% stake in Sizewell, on the understanding it would land the ultimate prize of building a reactor of its own design at Bradwell in Essex. But Chinese involvement in designing and running its own reactor on UK soil looked dead, according to both industry and government sources, given the deteriorating diplomatic relations after the government's decision to phase out Chinese firm Huawei's equipment from a new generation of telecoms networks. If a mobile network is considered too sensitive, it's hard to argue that a nuclear power station is not. If CGN are excluded, the government taking a direct stake in Sizewell is one of the options being considered, according to people familiar with the matter.
So that's the news bulletin, Martin. What do you make of what you've just heard? Because there's all sorts in there, isn't there? They keep using the word sources. which really means they're talking to government departments, I imagine. And the use of the word dead there to describe hopes that China was going to be involved. Now, China is not only involved at the Bradwell plant, which we're going to hear from now, that is over in Essex, a brand new site, which is 10 times the original old Magnox station plant. They've hit all sorts of problems in that Colchester Council is saying that they're going to oppose it in every way they can. Bradwell on Sea Parish Council, the local, and other local authorities have just turned down their planning permission for the groundworks that are needed to build that power station. I suppose the big question here is, if we're going to reject Huawei, are we also going to tell the Chinese to take a running jump when it comes to nuclear power?
Well, that was a suggestion made in the report that you just broadcast. And of course it is. I mean, if we're going to have a trade war with China to keep the Americans happy, then that's the sort of thing that's going to start happening, isn't it? Things that have been agreed for years are going to be thrown in the waste paper basket.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a confusing report because they're saying, oh yes, Sizewell might accelerate, but Bradwell probably won't happen. So the questions are, of course, for Hinkley, what do you make here of our local power station, which is something like halfway through construction at the moment?
Well, EDF are obviously building it, and EDF, again, is another state-owned entity, just like the Chinese state-owned nuclear power company. And I suppose, ultimately, if the Tory government wants nuclear power in Britain, it's going to have to be nationalised nuclear power, isn't it? I mean, there's no other option.
OK, so anyway, let's have a listen to Johnny Aldridge now. I interviewed him about Bradwell, because this is really right on the cusp of being launched, this project over in Essex. So he had all sorts to say about whether he thought it was appropriate or not.
Within 15 miles, you've got Morden and Colchester. Within 50 miles, you've got London. And I don't kind of see half of London being evacuated very easily. In fact, I would put that in the impossible category. So, you know, I to me, it's the wrong place. It really is. Okay. However, the way that renewables work is that you do need some kind of storage. And the problem that you have with nuclear power stations is they work against renewables and they work against storage. Because what happens is, at the moment, when there's a lot of wind and there's a lot of sun, yeah, we get more electricity than we can use. But you have to keep the nuclear power stations running because you can't turn them off. And because you can't turn them off, they have to continue to run. So they have to turn off the wind turbines and the solar panels, which is crazy. I mean, there's lots of the politicians will tell you that this will tide us over. It will complement the renewables. Well, it's nonsense. It doesn't. It works against the renewables. You have to develop other systems. You have to develop a smart grid. You have to develop some kind of storage in order to make the renewables work correctly. We've got both onshore and offshore wind farms here. The onshore one is 8 turbines, so not very big. It's 9 turbines, I believe. The offshore one is part of the London Array, which is huge, and is one of the 3 largest in the world, I believe. I think that Britain has got 3 of the largest ones in the world, and the London Array, I believe, is that they keep adding more and more wind turbines, as you can imagine. And interestingly, I've tried to look up some of the arguments for having nuclear power, and they go back some years. I think it's 2008 was when the government white paper came out that was in favour of the nuclear power. But in those times, of course, there wasn't much in the way of wind turbine. They've got nothing really to compare it with, other than coal, gas, and oil. And of coal, gas, and oil, and nuclear was the best option, so they went with that. But the world has changed a lot since then. It really has. Yes, I mean, coal is nearly stopped completely. So it's not much good comparing things with coal anymore, like they did in those days. And the wind and solar has moved on so much. And of course, people are trying to develop battery storage and other kinds of storage. I mean, this typically the sorts of things that would happen is if you've got a smart grid and you knew when there was a lot of renewable energy available, you could then put water heating on. I mean, in individual homes as well as in large things that use a lot of hot water. But we don't know that, so we can't do that. It's why you need a smart grid.
So that's Johnny Aldridge there from Bradwell, speaking to me a few weeks ago. As it turns out, Martin, it's looking less and less likely that nuclear power station is going to be built by the Chinese and the French. And also, I mean, I love what he's talking about there, is he's saying actually things are changing, the way of managing electricity, the idea that you can draw on a particular source when the rest of the demand is low. This can feed into the grid, not just in your home. And also that this whole idea that at times, say, for example, in the summer or late at night, it might be blowing a gale, but you can't use those wind generators because the nuclear power station is going to be ticking over on a low level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the thing about nuclear power is it only seems viable because of all the sunk costs you put into it. And in China and France, the state has basically decided to have a big nuclear power program. And once the state has done that and created a big nuclear power industry, they've then got to try and recoup the investment they've made in it, which means that they then try and sell on the technology to other countries, which is why they do it, because it doesn't pay in France or in China. And the really reason it doesn't pay is as soon as you count in what are you going to do with the waste, which lasts for thousands of years, it's quite obvious that it's not economic.
So I spoke also to Dr. Chris Busby, who now lives out in the Baltic states. I think is it Latvia or Lithuania or somewhere, after he was burgled by the police, would you believe? And they destroyed some of his experiments at his home. He is a long-time hero. Really, he's gone around and collected independently a lot of data on these nuclear power stations over the years and proven that that they have leukemia clusters around them. So the industry and the government denied this, but Chris went round and actually showed that there was cancer being caused both to animals and to people living around power stations. And even though it was officially completely denied, he proved it to be true. But Chris, I spoke to a few weeks ago about various things to do with the nuclear industry, and he had this to say about Hinkley.
All the activity that we're seeing near Bridgewater really going to just simply grind to a halt? We're going to be left with these half-built stations? That's what you're implying?
Yes. I think that's exactly what will happen. What will happen is that the bad guys who are running the show here are going to get the maximum amount of money out of it that they can and then go bankrupt. I mean, that's the way of the world now. What you do is you have some sort of building project. You see Boris Johnson is saying, oh, we're going to build, you know, we're going to build our way out of this desperate recession that's likely to come at us because we're spending so much money because nobody's doing anything because of the coronavirus. So we're going to build. What that means, that doesn't mean build. What that means is we're going to borrow money to build, okay? And so that's what people do. That's the name of the game. So you set up some bogus company like you know, Green Earth Cooperative. And then you get the planning people to, and this is already happening. He's opened up the planning all over the place. So you go to the planning people and you say, oh, we're going to build an enormous housing estate for all the poor people in the middle of that field over there. So you buy the field off the farmer for tuppence. And then you go to the banks and you say that this development is going to be worth 29 billion or million. And so the banks give you half of that. And then you put a few foundations in and then you go bankrupt and run off with the money. That's the way of the world nowadays. That's how money is made.
So that's Chris Busby, Martin, a pretty cynical view, but he's saying that actually a few people are going to make a load of money out of the whole Hinkley Power Station, but it will never finally be built.
Well, that's right, because in other words, it's not really a free market. It's underpinned by the government deciding that it wants to do it, which means basically that it's a win-win for those who are involved. Because they're not risking their own money in building it.
We're talking here really about a very weak government, aren't we? It's just subject to the nuclear lobby. The nuclear lobby gently twists its arm behind its back and it just signs on the dotted line without a by your leave.
Yeah, well, when you could say it's a weak government, but you could say it's a strong government pursuing the interests of the vested interests that control it. So it's not, you know.
Well, the government's not strong, otherwise surely it'd be kicking back and saying we're not spending any money on this.
But the thing is that they will use their powers to repress those who are opposing the policy. So in other words, if the private sector had to build nuclear power stations on their own dollar, and without support from the government, they wouldn't try it. But of course, once the government steps in, it's the same as with this test and trace system.
But the government hasn't stepped in with nuclear power, has it? It's always been there.
Well, no, the government created the nuclear power industry. There was no private sector nuclear power industry in the first place. And of course, at one stage, Margaret Thatcher thought of privatising the British nuclear power industry. And the City of London at that stage were really keen on privatisations. But I wrote a paper for the New Economics Foundation about all of this. As soon as they looked at the books, they said, we're not doing this. The only reason that there is nuclear power is literally because there was a nuclear weapons programme. And if you don't have a nuclear weapons programme, you might as well have a nuclear power programme. But otherwise,
haven't you got to have a nuclear power programme?
There's lots of countries that haven't got one, Tony.
If you want to have a nuclear... What I'm saying is, if you're going to have a nuclear weapons programme, you've got to have a nuclear power programme.
Oh, that's right. The CANDU reactor, which was sold to the Indian government by the Canadians in the 1970s, is the basis of their nuclear weapons programme. And the relationship between nuclear weapons program and nuclear power is intimate. But if you're going to have a nuclear weapons program, and some governments do, like us, then one of the ways they thought about this is, well, we'll have a nuclear power program as well, because if we're going to have nuclear weapons, we're going to have some waste, and we might as well use it for nuclear power.
Surely you can have a nuclear weapons program without a nuclear power program.
You can.
By buying plutonium and enriched uranium on the black market.
Or even on the open market.
Is there an open market in plutonium?
Well, no, what there is, the nuclear industry in Britain is entirely a product creation of the state, even though there are now private sector people making money out of it. And this is the way of crony capitalism that Britain operates on, which is that the government provides all the backup for the private sector to take the profits, and then if anything fails, the poor old taxpayer picks up the bill. And that is actually British policy going back to the 19th century, which is why we're in the massive cultural cul-de-sac that we've got ourselves into.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it, that Extinction Rebellion are basically pro-nuclear because of its low carbon footprint. Well, George Monbiot certainly is.
Yeah, but he's not Extinction Rebellion, he's George Monbiot.
Do you want to bet? He is Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah.
And in fact, here he is speaking I'm not sure if it's about a week ago or so, in central London at something called 55... Tufton Street, which is one of the big think tanks. I'm not quite sure which one it is. I'm not sure if he says it, which one it is. But here he is now talking about the role of think tanks, because these are the sort of organisations like these nuclear lobby groups we're thinking of that are so good at strong-arming government, Martin, isn't it?
Well, think tanks were invented in the US in the 60s and 70s because the corporate sector found that universities were too critical of what they were doing. So they created their own alternative to universities, the think tanks, which tell them what they want to hear.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to George Monbiot, the Guardian columnist. And here he is speaking to an Extinction Rebellion rally at 55 Tufton Street.
I can't say how much this means to me. 20 years I've been trying to draw attention to what these people really are. In 20 years I feel I've been banging my head against a brick wall. And now I feel there are loads of us banging our heads against a brick wall. So that's got some kind of progress, isn't it? Now, when people call Dominic Cummings an evil genius, they're only half right. A lot of the so-called genius bit is done in places like this. I mean, that's not to say they aren't evil as well, because obviously they are, but a lot of the policy making, a lot of the ideas that Dominic Cummings is credited with, a lot of the really radical right policies that this government is implementing emerge from places like this. from 55 Tufton Street, from 57 Tufton Street, from Lord North Street, from Great Smith Street, from Great George Street. This nexus of organisations calling themselves think tanks, and which obediently the media also calls think tanks. But these are not think tanks, except in as much as they think about tanks. They are lobby groups. They are no different to lobby groups like Bell Pottinger or Burson Marsteller, who represent devious, destructive, corporate and oligarchic interests, except for this: they do not reveal who funds them. This is a fundamental difference between them and people who come forward and say, we're representing the tobacco industry, we're representing the oil industry, we're representing the mining industry, and on their behalf, because they've paid us to do so, we're going to put their case across. These people are doing exactly the same, but not revealing on whose behalf they are doing it. It is a fundamental principle of democracy that we should know who is speaking. And what is speaking here? Hidden by opacity, hidden by this total failure of transparency and accountability, what is speaking here is the power of money. And the power of money is the greatest threat to democracy and the greatest threat to life on earth that we face. Now they have a name for the power of money, a euphemism for the power of money. They call it the market. And they talk about the market as if it's a law of nature, as if it's just something in the air, something in the water, something indefinable, which governs the way that we act. But what they call the market, this thing they say should effectively supplant democracy, this thing through which decisions should be made, is a forum within which wealth speaks, where there is $1, one vote, and those with the dollars are those who get to make the decisions. And the very purpose of the existence of these organizations is to translate the demands of extreme wealth into justifications that people will accept. It is to reframe, it is to refine, it is to hone the arguments until we end up believing the very opposite of where our interests lie. Until we end up believing that what is good for billionaires is good for everyone. Whereas what billionaires want is the extension of their own wealth and power at the expense of everyone and everything. And so, we are here to call them out.
So that was George Monbiot speaking last week, actually not this week, at the same time as the blockade of the newspapers, of course, which is, I don't think the Guardian was blockaded, it was the other newspapers. So it's almost like a kind of newspaper journalist war. But he's making some very important points there about these lobby groups, Martin, isn't he? I mean, whatever, you know, you don't have to agree with George to understand that this is an enormous hidden power influence. In fact, it's possibly, you could say in some ways, more powerful than the government itself. It can overwhelm governments, this enormous amount of money pushing specific lobbies.
The history of think tankery is that it really began in the 1960s in the US, as I said earlier. Because previously to that point, the universities had been the places that governments went to get policy and information and ideas to do things. But the universities gradually became, as far as the corporate sector was concerned, hostile territory. So think tanks were set up as a means of, creating an alternative to objective analysis of social problems. And he's quite right. The think tanks have be- I mean, the think tanks surrounding this government in particular are very, very influential. And, you know, the Mount Pelerin Society, for example, founded in the 1940s, has been massively influential in economics departments. You know, what happens is the universities now have become captured by think tankery to a large extent. And, you know, the analysis that George Monbiot is making there of the way it works is pretty much spot on. You know, ordinary people don't get much of a say. There's been an academic study done in the US which shows that ordinary people's interests are virtually never represented in policy proposals that governments carry through. It's virtually 100% decided by oligarchic factions.
He stood outside a specific building there with a whole bunch of lobby groups in them, most of them anti-climate change lobbies put there by the oil industry, but there are also some lobby groups that George would probably agree with, that are lobbies that would be on his side of the argument. So isn't it a bit hypocritical to be sort of calling out one lot of lobbyists where you're not calling out another lot?
Well, I think the point he's making there is there's no transparency. I mean, we know that in Scandinavian elections, for example, people, the different political parties are supported by the public purse according to their level of support. Now, that's just political parties in elections. But the very least we should expect is, if a think tank is making recommendations to government, we should know who funds it, who funds you. And of course, if we find out that you're being funded, for example, by the oil industry, then we can take with a pinch of salt what you're saying, and we may listen to it, but we know that it's the oil industry speaking. What the think tanks do is pretend that they're giving an objective analysis, because they won't tell you where their funding comes from. And of course, they won't tell you because that's what their analysis is geared to, making the funders' objectives more palatable to the general public.
I think it was when I was away, wasn't it, that we did that review of Planet of the Humans. The film Planet of the Humans shows how there's quite a lot of investment funds, in fact, smart money, apparently, if they call it smart money, is moving away from traditional investment funds into these green investment funds. One of them is called 350.org, and these have moved into renewables in a big way. And I mean, I think it would probably be paraphrasing to say that Planet of the Humans film, to say fossil fuel assets are simply being replaced by investments in plastics, mining, oil and gas. So there's a sort of shift going on from one type of bad thing to another type of bad thing.
Well, I mean, genuine green activists would call that greenwash. Everybody pretends that they're green now. Everybody's green. But of course, which basically we want to carry on doing what we've always done, which is exploiting the planet and people on the planet, and we don't want to change anything too much.
And the other thing
things must change, so everything must remain the same.
The other thing is these biomass energy. I mean, we're just talking about the nuclear industry, biomass energy, which effectively is now starting to chew into forests. The idea is a forest is growing for whatever 100 years, and then at the end of the 100 years, you chop it down and feed it into a power station.
Yeah, I mean, there's a spectrum in the green movement. Of course there is. You've got what you might call your respectable greens, who are all in favour, for example, of nuclear power and biomass energy. And then you've got your more radical greens, who are not in favour of any of those things. So you can't really say that there's a particular green view. But as I said earlier, the world, his wife and his dog, are all green these days. And that includes nuclear, you know, the Pentagon claims to be the greenest military on Earth, you know, and all the rest of it. And it's all part of basically propaganda.
So one of the things that George wasn't talking about in that discussion was how the Rockefeller brothers have been going green, investing in Halliburton. This is the sort of thing that we're not hearing from a lot of the green lobby. They freed themselves, apparently, the Rockefeller brothers, of fossil fuels. The foundation remained invested in companies including oil services giant Halliburton. The Koch brothers run multinational petroleum transportation partnership Inter Pipeline Limited, and Caterpillar, whose bulldozers are familiar at scenes of deforestation and Palestinian home demolition. So I suppose what George is doing is he's picking his fight and he's saying, well, look, we're going to have to forget about things like the Rockefellers still being involved in military stuff, etc., and just concentrate on trying to stop these basically pro, or the people who are trying to win the argument that global warming is a scam?
Well, I think leaving aside global warming one way or the other, there is a basic problem that those with money determine the agenda. And you've got a spread of views amongst the billionaire class. George Soros, of course, has got more liberal views than the general run-of-the-mill millionaire, billionaire, and that's why he comes in for such a lot of stick. But, of course, Sheldon Adelson is the biggest funder of US politics, and he is definitely a right-wing, pro-Zionist, anti-climate change, denying, you know, he's the one who chucks the most money at it. And he generally gets what he wants. And that's the way the US is run, and it's pretty much the way this country is run.
There's a pretty good article in The Grey Zone about a lot of this and some of the implications that came out of that film, The Planet of the Humans, which I think in a way was almost made for Extinction Rebellion activists, because it points out that the money is just shifting. It's not actually getting any more ethical at all.
Well, that's right. I mean, ultimately, the radicals believe, for example, that you're going to have radical land reform in developing countries. So it's not the problem of poverty and hunger in developing countries isn't because there isn't enough food. There is plenty of food. Poor people can't afford it. And, of course, in some parts of the world, like Kerala in southern India, poor people have been given access to land. In Brazil, they are immediately faced with repression, murder, and torture.
Okay,
and so that's the reality. And of course, we're not going to get a green revolution without a red revolution. The landowning classes have got to be dispossessed, peacefully or otherwise.
Does that mean people who own their own homes? The landowners?
Well, no. I'm talking about the big landowning classes in the developing countries.
Okay.
But of course, there's another issue about whether people, in this country, the property market is a big scam for the upper middle class to make money from doing nothing.
Well, the middle class, not necessarily upper middle
class.
Well,
I'm just saying that the whole thing is a lot of free money for people. Yeah, you get your foot on the housing ladder at any level, and that is free money.
But everyone wants to do that, don't they? This is hang on, Martin, because it's a basic human need to have somewhere to live, isn't it?
Yes, and the point is that in other countries there's a balance struck between the need or desire to own one's own home and the necessity to make sure everybody's somewhere decent to live. In Germany, large numbers of people, even wealthy people, do not own their own homes. They invest their money, if they've got any, in business. And that's another reason why Britain is so far behind German industry, because we don't invest in industry. We're good on conservatories, not so good on cars.
Okay, so it was let out last week. It's a fascinating article, and it's really a review of all the financial implications of the film Planet of the Humans by Michael Moore, which came out early this year. And the article is called Green Billionaires Behind Professional Activist Network That Led Suppression of Planet of the Humans Documentary. And we're talking here about these alternative so-called green investors that Mr. Monbiot would probably be patting on the back, having played quite an important role in suppressing this documentary and getting it taken off of YouTube, etc.
Well, I did read George Monbiot's critique of the documentary, and I think he had some fair points to make. But at the same time, what you've got to be aware of, what's it says in the Bob Marley song? Never let a politician grant you a favour. They will always want to control you forever. And this is, as you gradually move towards a rhetoric of inclusion and environmental concern, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. So everybody, as I say, everybody claims to be green. The Pentagon claims that they've got green bombs. And of course they're green.
Organic petrol.
Organic petrol, yeah.
Okay. So let's move on to Prime Minister's questions this week. And the deputy leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner, was standing in for Keir Starmer this week. She took Boris on square, face to face on the lockdowns, and particularly, well, actually criticising the failure of testing. Now, there's a big argument going on as to whether we should be testing people who aren't ill. But anyway, Angela Rayner got stuck in.
Angela Rayner.
Mr. Speaker, infections are rising. The testing system is collapsing. When you are the Prime Minister, you can't keep trying to blame other people for your own incompetence. We have the highest death toll in Europe, and we're on course for one of the worst recessions in the developed world. This winter, we are staring down the barrel of a second wave with no plan for the looming crisis. People can't say goodbye to their loved ones. Grandparents can't see their grandchildren, and frontline staff can't get the tests that they need. And what was the top priority for the COVID war cabinet this weekend? Restoring grouse shooting. I suppose, Mr. Speaker, it's good news for people like the Prime Minister's friend who paid for a luxury Christmas getaway to a Caribbean island and funded his leadership campaign and just so happens to own two grouse moor estates. So, Prime Minister, is this really your top priority?
Mr. Speaker, while the Labour opposition has been consistently carping from the sidelines throughout this crisis and raising, I think, issues that are tangential, if not scare stories, about what is going on, we are getting on with delivering for the British public. We're not only ramping up, massively ramping up, and Mrs. Speaker, she hasn't contested any of my statistics today about the extent to which this country is now testing more than any other European country. She hasn't disputed the massive acceleration in our programme. We are getting on. I'll answer the substance of her question. Thank you very much. We're getting on with delivering on the priorities of the British people. Getting us through this COVID crisis, delivering on making our country safer, by the way, bringing forward measures to stop the early release of dangerous sexual and violent offenders, which I hope that she will support, strengthening our union, Mr. Speaker, which in principle the front bench opposite should support, building more homes across this country, more affordable homes across this country, which you should support, in addition to recruiting more doctors, more nurses, and building more hospitals. Mr. Speaker, I don't think anybody is in any doubt that this government is facing some of the most difficult dilemmas that any modern government has had to face. But every day we are helping to solve them thanks to the massive common sense of the British people, who are getting on with delivering our programme, getting on with delivering our fight against coronavirus. And it's with the common sense, it's with the common sense of the British people that we will succeed, build back better and stronger than ever before.
Okay, so that's Angela Rayner, leader of the opposition, on Wednesday. How do you think she got on, Martin?
Well, I think she was, you know, she basically provoked Boris Johnson into a massive rant about it's completely different from what she was asking about. And
you could hear the backbenchers saying, why don't you answer the question in the background? And of course, he didn't, ultimately.
No. I mean, of course, I mean, and he didn't answer the question about grouse moors, did he?
Nothing.
Why have grouse moors been allowed to have more than six people?
Well,
this is a rather strange sort of thing, isn't it?
Well, it's
for
not,
them to decide
look,
that.
Okay, let's just take this from, obviously, you know, it's the same reason, surely, as to why you can have a football field or whatever with a lot of people, because there's a lot of air around, you know. It's not like it's an enclosed space. This is a big difference, surely. If you're looking at transmitting viruses, however they, you know, whether they are actually going to kill you or not, which doesn't seem to be even thought about, but a virus can be caught much more easily indoors or in a building than it can outside. The grouse moor, surely
but,
not.
But if I go to the park this weekend, I will not be allowed to be in a group of more than six people. If I go to a grouse moor, on the other hand, I can be in a group of more than six people. Why on a grouse moor? And of course, as she rightly pointed out, it's because the friend of Boris Johnson that paid for his trip to the Caribbean after he'd won the election just happens to own two grouse moors. And of course, he didn't answer the basic question because she's basically hit the bullseye. That's why he's decided to do it. And we were just talking about how people with money determine policy. There's an example of exactly how that happens.
I mean, if you're up on a grouse moor, surely people are spaced along anyway. You know, you've got your beaters. I mean, I'm not actually. I don't do shooting myself,
yes.
But you've got the beat. You have people spaced widely apart who shoot separately.
Well,
they're not all shooting from the same little unit.
If they're socially distanced, then there wouldn't be a question. They wouldn't need to have a rule about whether there was six or
maybe
six
it's
or
maybe
more.
Maybe it's in a little buggy that they take when they go up from, you know, wherever they pay their money.
Well, in actual fact, a lot of people who pay a lot of money to go to grouse moors want to go to grouse moors to meet the right people in the bunker. And of course,
it's a bit like golf, isn't it?
Yes,
but upper class.
Yes, more upper class than golf. And of course, grouse moors are actually, in fact, very environmentally problematic. They cause flooding and all sorts, you know. But that's another issue. But of course, they basically said, well, loads of people won't come to the grouse moor if they can't be in groups of more than six. And being a Tory government, and we did bung you a lot of money at the last election, surely you can give us a buy-in, best one.
Extinction,
and of course, he did.
Extinction Rebellion have got a particularly nasty. They don't like grouse moors as it is. Before all this happened, last year they were up on the grouse moors protesting against them. So you can kind of see what's going to happen here.
Yes, well, they're a bit of a red rag to a grouse, aren't they?
Or to the grouse shooter.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, is this could possibly be a bit dangerous if they're taking on a whole bunch of people with shotguns.
Well, maybe so, Tony. But I mean, Harold Wilson in the 1960s talked about Alex Douglas Hume, and he was basically he wasn't in Parliament because I think he was up in Scotland on his grouse moor, and he said, "Well, this is the grouse moor way of running the country." Because, of course, traditionally, Liberal and Conservative cabinets used to go grouse shooting at the weekend, where they used to do all their deals. And of course, that's not really the way the Labour Party does stuff, either then or now.
Whereabouts does the Labour Party do it? Down the pub?
Traditionally, yeah.
Okay. Anyway,
not anymore.
It was a hinting there, wasn't there, a bit at the sole idea of national unity being under threat. So there was a very, very short answer for Boris on this one. About...
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the week in which the Prime Minister announced the government's new strategy on obesity, the eating disorder charity Beat experienced a 165% increase in number of people contacting their support services. I am pleased that the Prime Minister is focused on obesity, which is a very serious national...
Well, quite what's happened there, but none of those are the right Prime Minister's questions. Martin, I'll see if I can find it. Maybe you could say what you make of what's going on with this apparent. Well, what seems to be happening is the Scots and the Welsh are ganging up on the English and saying, well, we're not going to be cooperating with your internal market deal when it comes to the end of the year and the so-called deal with the EU.
Well, the Scots and the Welsh do have gripes with this internal market bill, but the real international problem is with the Irish, and we've seen this week, they're basically talking of withdrawing from the withdrawal agreement, which they've already signed with the EU and with the Irish. But of course, what's happened this week is it's been spelled out to them pretty clearly that if they do that, they won't be getting any kind of trade deal with the United States of America.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll be able to listen to this question about the internal market bill now.
Does my right honourable friend agree that this government's internal market bill will protect our United Kingdom, strengthen our mission to level up and back our negotiators?
Yes. Mr. Speaker, I could not have put it better myself.
And that actually was the only answer he gave. I couldn't have put it better myself. In fact, maybe his office did write it himself. Because that was a very friendly question from a Conservative. In fact, we're hearing quite a lot of that. That's an American.
Mm. I thought that was... That's not a Yorkshire accent, is it?
No, it's not. We're getting all these sort of foreign voices now coming into Parliament. But that's not what this is about.
Well, she's
this is
elected.
Really...
She represents whoever she is.
Oh, yeah, well, she's been elected, you know. Who is she representing? The United States or, you know, isn't it curious how so many more American voices have suddenly appeared on the scene as Brexit's coming along, supposedly, if it ever happens, it'd be a miracle or disaster. But on the BBC, we're hearing loads more American voices, but even in Parliament too. But what about the substantive issue here? What is going on with the Welsh and the Scots and the English falling out?
Well, It's the reason why we're hearing American voices this week is because the Americans have been dragged into this because of the Irish dimension to the problem. And of course, the Irish America is quite influential across the aisle in the United States. It's not just Democrats who've got Irish ancestry. So that's the reason why they've been mouthing off this week. What's going to happen is the internal market bill means that government in Westminster will determine that things that were previously determined in Brussels will not be devolved to the devolved assemblies. They will be devolved only to Westminster, which means that Westminster can then override decisions that are made, or decisions that they would like to make in the devolved assemblies. So it's more centralisation of power in London, which is what the Welsh, the Scots and the Irish have been complaining about for hundreds of years.
Right, so so we're going to go and talk a bit about the COVID and all that stuff after we've had some music. But before we do that, Martin, final thing on Prime Minister's questions is this whole idea of people having eating disorders. There's a lot of people apparently getting fatter because of lockdown, and that came up at Prime Minister's questions as well on Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the week in which the Prime Minister announced the government's new strategy on obesity, the eating disorder charity Beat experienced a 165% increase in number of people contacting their support services. I am pleased that the Prime Minister is focused on obesity, which is a very serious national health issue. But as the chair of the APPG on eating disorders, I have been contacted by many who suffer from an eating disorder, and they have approached me with concerns with certain aspects of his obesity strategy and the adverse effects it would have on them. Will the Prime Minister take these concerns seriously and commit to arrange to a meeting between sufferers of an eating disorder, myself, and the relevant minister in his health team?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and I'm acutely conscious that there are no glib, easy answers in this area of public policy, and I happily undertake that the relevant minister should meet with the Honourable Lady as fast as possible to understand her concerns and the concerns of her constituents.
Right, so eating disorders. Now, one of the things that we've seen a lot, big increase in is the number of suicides, Martin, but surely a lot of this eating disorder stuff is to do with basically comfort eating, where people feel that they're they feel a sense of anxiousness, that their future is unclear, that there's basically an abusive relationship with the authorities, with the government, a hostile environment being created for people, whether they're asylum seekers or whether they're the poor, particularly under the Conservatives. And actually, overeating is a natural reaction to that sort of thing.
Well, as you know, Tony, as the Prime Minister rightly said, it's quite a complicated issue. The need, you know, the concerns that an individual might have about their eating, you know, you can't really necessarily generalise from one person's problems. But of course, there is a major problem with poorer people overeating, as you say, comfort eating. And of course, what people often forget is that if you've got a microwave in your house, it's a lot quicker to just whack something in the microwave than cook properly if you've got to pay for electricity and gas. So, you know, they say, well, why don't
it's
you
It's also
have...
time, isn't it?
Yes,
so time. A lot of people don't have the time.
That's right. If you're working two jobs in a zero-hours contract, you haven't really got time to have a proper meal. I mean, in France, for example, historically, they had a very long lunch hour, and in Spain. And that actually is a very helpful way for people to eat properly and sensibly, because it's big, you know, it's built into the day that you're going to have a long and comfortable lunch hour, 2 hours to eat your lunch.
Okay, so being in a kind of financial cage, you know, imprisoned in an economic lifestyle that you can't necessarily, you know, so for example, your outgoings are more than your income, this sort of thing gets people tense. And as a way of just kind of getting through the day, sometimes people eat. But have you got any tips? I'm not saying, because you and I are a bit portly, but have you got any tips, you think, for, you know, what to eat and how to, you know, reduce your weight, overeat?
I actually went to the nurse this week to have a checkup, and yes, my weight has gone up over lockdown. And when we had Ian Henschel here last week, he definitely mentioned that my weight had gone up. So I'm getting the message, and I'm trying to cut down on I mean, basically during lockdown, I was eating quite a lot because, you know, it fills the day up, doesn't it? So, you know,
it's not just the day it fills up, is it?
No, that's the problem.
So I would, just one thing I say is you know, as a basic discipline, don't eat anything after 7 p.m. It's quite a good little discipline if you can get into that. You know, have an early supper, an early dinner, and then don't eat and don't snack or whatever in the evenings. Also, of course, try and build exercise into your week. Like, say, for example, cycling, you know, that sort of thing. Not that I do it. But,
well,
I mean,
I'm just saying. I mean, I don't think that the audience really needs our advice about healthy living, Tony.
Well, no, but I mean, maybe we do.
Maybe we do.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to be hearing a bit more about coronavirus, the lockdown lunacy, the mask madness, after we've heard a tune. Now, this tune is from, they call themselves, they're actually, I think, anonymous, but they call themselves Frankie Goes to Nowhere, and it's called COVID-19 the Musical.